And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. All of my guests have interesting subjects. No two of them are related to each other. My first guest understands the challenges of going from being a peer at work to becoming someone's boss. We discussed how to make the transition from bud to boss without alienating friends, yet maintaining effectiveness. My next guest will discuss the 2011 federal budget. He's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, and he's a senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. We'll discuss how President Obama's budget speaks to Wall Street and ignores the voters. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Thomas Ferguson received his PhD from Princeton University and formerly taught at MIT and the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author or co-author of several books, including Golden Rule and Right Turn. His articles have appeared in many scholarly journals, including the Quarterly Journal of Economics, International Organization, International Studies Quarterly, and the Journal of Economic History. He is a longtime contributor and editor to The Nation and a member of the editorial boards of the Journal of Historical Society, the International Journal of Political Economy. He also serves on the advisory board for the Institute of the New Economic Thinking. Welcome to the show, Tom. How are you today?
Hi there. Well, look, it's actually reached 50 degrees in Boston, so I feel actually fantastic.
It's a heat wave. Throw off the sweater and go dancing in the streets after this interview.
Well, okay, I'll think about that last injunction.
All right. Sounds good. Well, let's jump into it, because I brought you on the show. You are a thought leader in business. You're a thought leader in economics. The White House says that President Obama's 2011 budget proposal will cut deficits by $1.1 trillion over the next 10 years. And it calls for a mix of strategic spending to boost economic competitiveness and selective belt tightening in other areas. On the surface of it, this sounds like a pretty good thing, Tom. So what's wrong with the budget as you see it?
Well, all right. So I'd say, look, the real budget deficit problem is substantially different than the way the White House is treating it. And you got to distinguish between the long and the short versions of it. And they know this, but they don't tend to thematize it in their public stuff. In the short run, you're looking at, meaning the next 3 years, you're looking at an economy in which unemployment is going to stay very high. And in that context, despite the recent good news in the economy, I don't think that they should be in the business of cutting expenditures yet. It's too early to do that. They just can't keep cutting total demand in the economy. I know they think that their tax cut and the other measures in that 210 tax bill that passed in December, which allows businesses to expense just about any investment for this year, and then the extra cash they loaded into unemployment is going to give them a boost. And I agree, but at the end of the year, I suspect you're going to lapse back into slow growth. I mean, they may actually believe that the economy is going to catch fire. I think they're really in a so-called balance sheet recession. That is to say, you've got a lot of businesses that have borrowed a lot in the previous decade. They bought assets with that. The assets have collapsed, but they still got the debt. So they're all in debt pay down or deleveraging mode. And banks, are capital constrained. Many of them are. Our regulators have not pushed those folks to write off the bad loans. They know that. And so they're not going to take very much risk. They're not lending. I don't think that's going to change. So I would worry about the short run a lot. I think it just feeds silly views about deficits. In the long run, the president doesn't do much. I mean, given what they did with the tax cut, if they were to extend in 210, if they were to extend that all the way after, just for 2 years, if they extended the tax cuts for upper-income Americans in the way that some like the Republicans have demanded and many Democrats have sort of talked about, I'd say they'd create a substantial a deficit problem. I mean, I'm not a believer that the sky falls if the debt-to-GDP ratio, hits some magic number like 90% or something like that. I don't think there's much evidence for that.
Just look at Argentina.
Yeah, but I mean, Argentina was, I think, in the end, a good deal worse than that.
Mm.
But the case for, I mean, look, Britain in the Industrial Revolution had debt to GDP ratios of over 200% for much of it. The U.S. is nowhere near that. We're somewhere sitting right now at around 61 or 62, though it's going to rise a good deal. Anyway, my sense would be what you want to do is stabilize the debt to GDP ratio, and you can move with a fairly high limit. You don't have to. There's no sense, I think, there's no evidence that rolling it back 10 or 15% or down to 40, which I think was the Budget Deficit Commission's proposal, actually, you don't get anything for that in the end. Anyway, they need to do something to cut. They have some serious budget problems, and the one that really matters is medical spending. And that one they need to address. They don't have a problem with Social Security. They just don't. But the medical spending thing is a problem. And the president has basically no new proposal on that. I didn't like the version of the health care bill he did much because it contained so many things to push up costs. I mean, the worst thing he did was to preclude the government from bargaining down with Big Pharma on drug costs. That's ridiculous. And you're talking trillions there over 10 years. This is not a minor matter. And I frankly think that they should have done something on the private health care cost control side. I mean, the private insurance does not work well anywhere in the world unless you very strictly regulate it. I mean, there are some countries that do medical care by using private insurers. I mean, the Netherlands does that, the Swiss do that, the Germans do that. Those systems only work if you really regulate them on a basic package of benefits, and you have got to prevent so-called adverse selection. That is, where the private folks try to shift all the expensive patients onto the government and then skim the ones that are healthy for themselves.
All right. Hold on now, Tom. We've had a lot of information go under the bridge here. I want to circle back around. I do want to talk about the health care. I want to put that aside for just a minute, go back to the federal budget, some of the things that you said there.
Sure.
First of all, looking at the budget, it's going to save $1.1 trillion over the next 10 years. That's what the government is saying right now. Well, a couple of things. First of all, President Obama will long be out of office in 10 years' time. So none of the pigeons are going to come home to roost with him.
I agree that you never underestimate what a politician will do to kick the can forward. I am not making a pitch that these are all wonderful folks who mean exactly what they say or say what they mean.
Well, that's true. And so we agree on that point. But even the $1.1 trillion that's proposed in the budget as it stands right now is in stark contrast to the Office of Management Budget, which says these numbers are fallacious. They're built on growth that is probably not going to happen in the 4 to 5% range. And we're struggling along at 2.2 to 3.0% growth right now.
Yeah,
so,
but I think you mean CBO, right? OMB is the president's own bureau.
Beg your pardon.
That would be real news.
Beg your pardon. I did misspeak.
Yep.
Yes, the CBO is saying that this is fallacious thinking and that we're not going to see growth rates in the 4 and 5% range like we had in the go-go 1990s. So
well,
right off the bat, it's built on a false premise. We're building this budget on a base of sand.
Okay, my take on this, I have written, my friend Rob Johnson and I have a paper out on the Roosevelt Institute website, New Deal 2.0, on looking at the CBO comparisons in detail. My memory is that the latest CBO revision, which just popped out a couple weeks ago, which is a little later than the one we wrote about, has growth finally returning to what they're calling like trend or something around 2015. I mean, you're right, in other words, that they are saying, and I think very realistically, that the economy will grow very slowly. And our take on that is, look, this is not given in the sky that you're stuck with a real low growth rate. I mean, that's why I'm moderately sympathetic to the president's proposals to do some spending on infrastructure and education. Those tend to raise the rate of growth, and I think that's a good idea.
But they raise the rate of growth in the short term, and then they disappear.
No, they don't. You still better. If, for example, you build, say, a really good You don't necessarily do this across the whole United States, which is a little bit kind of strange. But if you build yourself, say, really good transportation systems, you get cost of reductions that last for years. I mean, in general, infrastructure spending makes sense, and it's tremendously useful to educate the population. And if everything works out better, even for people, a point I like to make to folks is, which is true, even if you never go to college, if you won't go to work in a state that has a high percentage of the state educated in college, your wages are almost certainly going to be higher. There are a lot of spillover benefits on that.
All right. I buy that. But any long-term transportation plan, and right now the president is proposing high-speed rail. High-speed rail has been turned down by a number of states already. And that type of infrastructure, while important, probably isn't as important as rebuilding our bridges, rebuilding our dams. Just ask the folks in New Orleans about that.
I'm with you. That's why I'm not. I think the idea of building high-speed rail through big chunks of the United States probably doesn't work. Though I haven't looked in detail at some of the cost estimates. I mean, you know, it works on the East Coast. I mean that. And, you know, that's the one place where, as far as I can tell, they've been actually very slow to sort of get programs going. It's a little hard to understand that. But you know, between Maine and, say, North Carolina, that's a place where you could use high-speed rail because you have no hope of putting lots of folks on either, you know, I mean, if you ever tried the New Jersey Turnpike in the summer, you'll understand.
It's murderous, that's right. But out here, Tom, out here, the first proposal rail is going to go from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, which, of course, goes through a lot of barren, desolate area, so that's easy to build. However, you know, all that's going to do is boon Las Vegas's tourism. That's really the only benefit there.
Well,
most people would rather go to San Francisco, I would think, business people.
Be a little careful on that, because if you look at the experience of the New Deal, which was building airports and some roads, though nothing like the highway expansion.
Of 55.
Later. That turns out to stimulate growth in a lot of funny. A large chunk of the far west, for instance, has become a huge retail distribution place where people are like Best Buy and other people stick a lot of their stuff out there. And you've actually seen some economic growth in places like in Colorado and Nevada in parts, or you did before 2008, that was sort of building on the fact that land was cheap. You build transportation better there, you'd probably get a lot of spillover, but I'm very sympathetic to the estimates that suggest that, you know, as I, you know, I actually am hearing from you that you are too. You get your total economic benefits are several times the actual value of the project. Indeed, in the mid 90s, there was apparently a list of these sort of type projects that the Clinton folks had, and they had internal estimates, which they never published. I asked these guys, why haven't you done it, inside the Office of Management and Budget, that said they were getting social rates of return, 30 or 40%. It makes a lot of sense to do that when you can borrow. I mean, the government can borrow right now at like 1%, I mean, because the Fed's pegged low, you know, rates.
Well, yes, go on.
It makes a lot of sense to borrow at 1% to get high rate of return social projects. I think that would be very good policy. I wish the Obama administration would take that.
Well, we're talking to Thomas Ferguson, everybody. We're battling back and forth over the budget that has been proposed by the president. And the thing of borrowing, Thomas, though, is that somebody's got to be able to buy those bills, those treasuries that we put out there. And unfortunately, we're going to come to the end of the road there. The Chinese and the Japanese may get tired of buying our debt in order to finance these things.
I think the best Japanese economist going is Richard Koo at Nomura Securities, and he makes this very simple point, which is if you accept the analysis of a balance sheet recession where you have effectively businesses hoarding cash for years and not going into debt themselves if you accept that, then you get a huge pileup of surplus funds. I mean, in fact, you don't have to even sell the debt that much to the Chinese or the Japanese. A big chunk of new debt is actually being bought by U.S. companies there. I mean, I don't believe that you've got a major problem with the size of the U.S. external debt anywhere near that yet.
All right.
And if you had one, you'd see it in the interest rates right now, you know, for 30-year rates. They're nothing like that. They're just not that interesting.
All right, we're talking to Thomas Ferguson. And, Thomas, I want to return now to something that you brought up earlier about health care. And you posit that addressing long-term budget issue really does require bringing the U.S. health care costs back in line with other major countries with better records. You quoted or you cited the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Germany as those countries. Now, my first question for you.
Countries. There are others. I mean, Canada, Japan. Almost everybody. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we do not do well on international indicators of things like lifespan or infant death.
No, we don't. And if those are your only metrics, that is true. However, looking at us, we're also a country that is, you know, three times larger than any of those other countries that you cited as well. So we have logistical problems involved in this. So talk to us about how we reform healthcare, because we've just gone through a battle just a year ago about healthcare.
It was horrible. Look, my take is fundamentally, you got to realize this, is that the most of the markets in the healthcare industry are not competitive. Now, you know, there may be a very good reason for that, which is it may be impossible to make them competitive, where you've got to rely on expert assessment, where the experts get paid under how much they assess. I mean, that's a serious problem. But basically, you know, it's the insurance markets are not competitive. And medical instrument markets are not competitive. The hospital itself, they're not very competitive either, typically. They're a chain of oligopolies. And you have got to, and you can see that the impulse after the healthcare bill passed, you can see a round of mergers in hospitals and other types. You see both, you know, horizontal mergers between people in the sort of same industry. You also see a lot of vertical stuff where, you know, hospitals are linking up to some of the sort of intermediate testing firms and things like that, and the doctors too. I mean, I live in Massachusetts, which is sort of a testing ground for all this stuff. Our package, of course, came from a Republican governor.
From Mitt Romney.
I can't resist mentioning this. But hey, now that's life. And you can see mergers everywhere. This is clearly done in part because they're planning to pick up more price reduction advantages. That is, say, reduction in competition. And it's got to the point where everybody is beginning to talk about it.
All right. But we're going to have to leave it there, Thomas. I'm afraid we've run out of time. We'll have you back in the future because I'd like to discuss it in more detail.
Much.
Thomas, if somebody wants to learn more about you, learn more about your writings, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
I would just go to New Deal 2.0, the Roosevelt Institute website, and look there.
New Deal 2.0, the Roosevelt Institute website. Tom, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.